This will be an interview with Florette Senegren on August 15th, 1985, in North Miami Beach. Test.
Testing. 1, 2, testing. Again. Testing. 1, 2, testing. All right, now if I'm lucky, my Yiddish intonation won't come through.
All right, so I'd just like to begin, as I said, with something about your background. And you said that your family was a family of craftsmen and designers in New York. Is that right?
My grandparents came from Russia, Poland. And depending upon what year it was, my grandfather was a carpenter and cabinet maker. My grandmother designed clothing, designed knitwear.
Did she do that in the old country as well?
She and her father had what they called a factory. I'm inclined to believe it was in the back of the house, and they must have had 4 or 5 sewing machines, and that consisted of a factory.
And what town was this?
The town, now, this is difficult, Piednitz, which is...
In present-day Poland?
It's on a border. I really don't know if it's Russia or Poland. Mm-hmm. We've not been back. And my mother designed feathered millinery.
Mm-hmm. Now, your grandparents came to the United States. They're the first generation that came to the United
they
States.
They are the first generation. My mother, my grandfather came first. A few years later, he sent for my grandmother. Mm-hmm. Who had 2 children, the oldest of whom was my mother.
This was New York?
They came to Brooklyn. And one of the few Jews who didn't go to the East Side. And my mother must have been about 4 years old at the time. I was born within the family. We all lived very close together. And I was born within the family housing area. We always had 1 or 2 houses and apartments close together. Okay. I didn't show any talent at all until my grandmother, who I adored, said to me, "I don't know how someone with 2 left hands came into our family." And that's when I decided I'll show her. Mm-hmm. And I learned to knit. And crochet, and from there.
Did she teach you?
No, this was a surprise for her. Ah. I went to a lady who lived around the corner, and I told her what I wanted, and she taught me. Mm-hmm. I must have been about 10 or 11 at the time. And this was a surprise for my grandmother. She was so touched by it. At any rate, from there I progressed to... I started to design my own clothing. I took classes and learned how to sew, not very well to this day. And then I progressed to needle points all along the way, becoming proficient enough to design.
Mm-hmm. Now, the needle point and all the sewing lessons you took, were needle point, were those lessons, or was this again like from women in the neighborhood?
No, needle point, by this time, I was studying through textbooks. Uh-huh. I was an adult, and I was studying textbooks, and I taught uh-huh. myself needle point.
Now, your mother, you said, was...
Was a designer of feathered millinery. As a child, I still have the little round knife. We would sit at the kitchen table at night with a little pot of glue and piles of feathers... and a little round knife, and she would teach me how to put a little glue on my finger while I hold the knife, pick up a feather, dip it again mm-hmm. in the glue, and overlay them on the frame of the hat. Mm-hmm. It was just lovely learning how to use your hands.
Mm-hmm. So this sort of using of your hands and the interest in that was sort of bred within your family family tradition, but your specific...
Yes.
Interests in needlepoint and sewing, and I mean the skills. Those skills were not acquired within your family.
They were acquired elsewhere, because they were so proficient in my family. I could never be as good as they were. So uh-huh. that I just went out. They never thought of themselves as talented. Mm-hmm. This was what they did,
right.
And they did it. And since they could do it better than I could do it, they'll do it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So by the time I was an adult, everyone started telling me how wonderful this was, and I realized that people considered it a talent.
The needlepoint? Or
any of the work. Mm-hmm. Any of the work. I became tired of needlepoint, and I had discovered the craft of weaving, but I hadn't done it. Mm-hmm. This was about, now it's 1985, this was 1970, mm-hmm. 69 or 70.
What has your career been in the interim? Had you been doing sort of
I was a professional volunteer for an officer for organizations, and then for a short time I was a travel agent, and many little things, mm-hmm. all the time working with my hands, mm-hmm. but not professionally.
But were you doing weaving?
Touched a loom up until 15 years ago. And 15 years ago, we were on a trip through Mexico. I was getting very tired. I had been doing needlepoint for my temple and for friends who requested it. I was beginning to sell. I had bought and sold antiques, so many little things. And we were on a motorhome trip, and we went into San Miguel de Allende, into the Institute, mm-hmm. and beautiful. I saw the large looms, and that was it. I had to get my hand on a loom. That summer, we went to Nova Scotia through the Maritime Provinces, and that's where I sat down in front of a large loom, mm-hmm. for the first time. That was it. There were no other, as far as I was concerned, for me, there were no other crafts.
Was that at sort of a crafts institute?
This was at a provincial, of the provinces, it was at a provincial park.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave craft courses. Mm-hmm. The women who came there, the Canadian women who came there, would sit at the looms and weave yardages so that they would have fabric to sew for clothing in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big cottage industry,
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat at one of the large looms, not realizing how much there was to know. They were just giving me the tail end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And once I threw a shuttle, that was it. Mm-hmm. I had to learn how to use a loom.
Let me just backpack a bit about the needlepoint. You said you were doing needlepoint for the temple and for friends, but not professionally. But
no.
What sort of things would you be doing for the temple?
I would design wall hangings and interpret it through needlepoint.
Mm-hmm.
I did things that I would give to their bazaars and auctions. If friends saw things in my house that they liked,
mm-hmm.
or they saw me wearing clothing that they liked, and they said, gee, would you make it for me?
Mm-hmm.
Only if they offered to pay. I never took money.
Mm-hmm.
But only if they offered to pay would I do it for them.
The temple hangings would have been more your own sort of creative work rather than the Talasium type thing.
There, it's all creative. My Talasium, I feel, is my most creative work.
I was wondering if you did sort of traditional Jewish...
Always on Jewish themes.
Themes, but the temple hangings are not something like the...
There's nothing prescribed.
Right.
Oh, nothing prescribed,
mm-hmm.
but my interpretations of either... There's one particular one I'm thinking of. There were lots of things, and this was in the 60s, the late 60s, early 70s, and the social tenor of the times, there was so much that was bothering me, judaically and socially, sociologically, and I interpreted that in Judaic terms,
mm-hmm.
and that's a wall hanging for the temple we belonged to at the time, the synagogue we belonged to at the time in Long Island,
mm-hmm.
so that there were those things.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever knit or crochet yarmulkes prior to,
Here and there, here and there, but nothing much.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that much creativity in it at the time.
The patterns for that, do you learn how to do that from...
There's a formula for it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you learn the formula? Was that...
Books. Millions of books.
Uh-huh.
There are always books and pamphlets and trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
Yarmulkes are not my big thing. I did them because my husband needed some,
mm-hmm.
and I can't see buying when I can do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
My children needed some, And if we didn't have any from weddings and bar mitzvahs and for the holidays, mm-hmm. I wanted them to have what I
so
did.
So you would do it for your
so
family.
I would do it for my family. I have a batch that I did at home that if we have company Friday night when we make the blessings over the wine and the bread, so I have sets, crocheted, that I've crocheted,
mm-hmm.
That I have for company for all the men so that mm-hmm. they have blending yarmulkes.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's
that is
very limited what you can do sort of creatively with a yarmulke, isn't it? I mean,
well, within, you see, doing yarmulkes, if you want to do patterns, just as in weaving, it's based on a grid principle, even though it's round,
mm-hmm.
and you work with a graph.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, yarmulkes are very simple. You just change colors.
But is there a prescribed pattern?
Religiously?
Yeah,
no.
Yarmulkes,
no. No. Nothing prescribed. Mm-hmm. You can do it very creatively. But as far as the ABCs of it are concerned, you must work with a grid pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as you must work with a grid pattern on in any weaving, mm-hmm. any form of weaving, which is why weaving in the round on a loom is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what else do you want to know?
The Talasium, then, you got interested in weaving 15 years ago, and then how did you begin doing
okay.
the Talasium?
When we moved down here, incidentally, Talasium is the Yiddish word,
right.
plural. Talis is the singular.
Yes.
In Hebrew, it's talit, and the plural is talitot.
Okay. And, all right, but you moved down here when?
We moved down here in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, at that time, I ordered my large loom. By that time, I was weaving. I was weaving since 1970. My husband had a campground. We had a campground up in the Catskill Mountains for 3 years, and during the summers, I was taking weaving lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a loom, but I was taking weaving lessons. That's where I learned branch weaving.
Mm-hmm.
We moved down here, and I got the large loom. I had been working with frame looms and small looms, and then I went into the large loom. Again, I had to take lessons from a teacher to learn how to use my large loom.
Mm-hmm.
I have always been Judaic-minded. I'm an active Jew. And I started...
Orthodox or...?
I'm not Orthodox. I'm conservative. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I am. Ever, as I learn, as you learn, you keep evolving.
Right.
And... I was raised by my grandparents Orthodox. I evolved into conservative, and who knows? I think I'm going back
mm-hmm.
to an. It isn't back, but you evolve as
mm-hmm.
you study. I was practicing double weaving, and I said, "Well, I'm going to make bags." And naturally, my frame of mind, I would think of bags to hold talitot and tefillin. Tefillin are the ritual straps and boxes that men use to pray in the morning.
Yes.
I think in the evening, too. Just in the morning. At any rate, I started to do
these
bags.
Bags have a name? Did you just say?
Talis and tefillin bags.
Okay. That's
and then it just wasn't satisfying enough. It took one of my friend's sons, who I had known since he was incubating in his mother's stomach, came to me. They lived down here. And he said, "My aunt is going to Israel. She wants to order a talis for me." And I said, "No, you're going to weave one." And I said, "Charles, you're crazy. What do I know about it?" He said, "You're going to weave it for me." It took me a year of research, speaking to rabbis and studying the Bible and many different aspects mm-hmm. before I had the temerity to start to weave it.
And you had no other person here that you knew that was doing it that you could...
I didn't know if anyone was doing it or not. Mm-hmm. I have since found out that there are people throughout the country who are doing it. We've
mm-hmm.
met
mm-hmm.
each other. Some of us have met each other or we're in correspondence. And... I started to weave it, and everything went wrong that could go wrong. I was sure nothing would ever happen. I was weaving it 2 inches at a time, and I told his mother, I said, this will never be. It came out, and it really came out beautiful. So that there was more weaving than I was just doing. I had a feeling of more than just me.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the mistakes, and to this day I say, Charles, please get another one. He says, oh, no, I won't wear any other than this.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I started to weave mm-hmm. Tally Tote. And a weaver never gets rich, because this is the craft that takes the longest period of time of
mm-hmm.
any craft I know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's such a great satisfaction in doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it, I didn't think I would find it as creative as I do,
mm-hmm.
but I do find it creative in trying to get different feelings
mm-hmm.
across. I'll weave one type of tallit when I have rabbis in mind, because they stand behind a pulpit and they need deeper colors that can be thrown off. And then there's I'll try to weave a refraction, such as an illumination that you'll see in ketubot,
mm-hmm.
where I'll go from dark to light with shiny. My rabbi just told me the other day when he saw one of them, he says, you know, that's from Bereshit. He says, because the earth, air, and skies, strangely enough, it's not here. I have it at home. But I have a tapestry called Earth, Air, and Sky. So I guess I've been concerned without realizing it about the same
mm-hmm.
types of things. And I love what I do. There's a peculiar process I go through. When I start, I say it's going to be nice. And then when the first pattern comes out, because they're mirror images at each end,
mm-hmm.
when the first pattern comes out, I think it's so beautiful. And then about halfway through, I say, whatever made me think I could weave something that's decent? And
mm-hmm.
I think it's horrible, but it's on the loom. I may as well finish it. And then when I finish it and I wash it and I fold it, it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty well satisfied. By the time I send it out, I like it again.
Now, when you did you begin just weaving for friends and family, and then you
got
no?
Right after that, I started to weave for my husband. The poor man still doesn't have one of my handwoven talisim that are his forevermore, because every time we show it, it's sold,
mm-hmm.
and he's a good-natured soul. He doesn't mind.
Mm-hmm.
I started to weave with the intention of selling my weavings.
Mm-hmm. And then so you just began to be known in the area?
In the local area. I did some local shows. My first show was at a very large Reformed temple on the beach, Miami Beach. I showed both Beth Shalom.
Mm-hmm.
I showed my talitot as well as my secular weavings, and lovely publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And this past spring, I did the Rabbinical Assembly. I was an exhibitor at the Rabbinical Assembly Convention at the Eden Rock Hotel. In October, I'll be going out to Los Angeles for the HUAC Convention, which is the administrative arm of the Reformed movement.
Mm-hmm.
I've been invited as one of their accredited artists.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I was delighted with that.
Now, when you get, say, someone calls you and asks you to make one for them,
yes.
You were telling about the different attitudes you had when you picture a rabbi or the. Do you sort of create it for the particular person, or is it, in other words, when you have some.
Yes. What happens is I try to sell what I have.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're delighted, especially if they're in a hurry. Sometimes, because there's a long wait. They have to wait a minimum of 4 months
mm-hmm.
if they order a tallit. Now, what happens is either they'll come to me and they'll see what I have, and from there tell me what they like. Working within their parameters, I'll create something. I don't let them give me the exact details.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell me their color. They'll point out among my stock the type of things they like,
mm-hmm.
because it's something they will live with for the rest of their lives and pass on to the next generation, which is another thing. A Jew is buried in his talis. And I say, my talis, you can be buried in a less expensive talis. My talis, somebody passed on to your children and your children's children. Mm-hmm. Because there's just as much kavana, which is a spiritual feeling, in having something that belonged to your ancestors. Right. So I will design within certain parameters. Anytime someone restricts me too much and I feel, oh, I can never make something good, and there's one here that this is an example of it. No, not this. There's another one that I have at home, an example of it. I feel, oh, I can't do it. Well, I'll just do it and get it over with. Somehow I find those restrictive parameters work to my creative benefit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And something nice and new always evolves.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to know some of the restrictions?
Yes, yes. For example, why don't we talk a little bit about okay. tradition?
Now, traditionally, a tallit is worn by men.
Mm-hmm.
In the reform movement and in the conservative movement, women will now wear it. A tallit, except for the night, Kol Nidre night, the night before the day of Yom Kippur, men do not wear tallitot after sundown. They wear it morning, afternoon services, and early evening.
Mm-hmm.
It should, the finest, according to Leviticus, the finest, the most desirable is made of wool. I have seen some made all of silk. I don't mix. The only restriction that have ever been given to me by the rabbis is not to mix linen and wool. I carry it a little further than that for my own peace of mind. I will use wool and silk as well as chemical fibers if I have to, but the body of my tallit is always wool. I will sometimes weave silk or rayon or metallic. These are animal fibers or chemical fibers. Even in my secular clothing, I will weave cotton and linen, but I'll never weave wool and cotton. I shouldn't say never. I will try never to weave wool and cotton,
mm-hmm.
or linen and wool, or linen and silk. I try to separate my animal fibers from my vegetable fibers.
Is that prescribed some?
It depends how far you want to carry it. It's
uh-huh.
it's this business of. They call it shatnets when it's applied to fiber, but it's the same type of thinking that goes into kashrith about not mixing milk and meat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of the exact quotation. The milk of the mother. Well, I won't even bother because mm-hmm. I'm not sure of that. At any rate, that is prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
It is proscribed and it must be. In addition, it should be very beautiful. When one prays to God, one wears his or her most beautiful garments. This is just a shawl. There's nothing mystical or inherently mystical. A thing is a thing. These are called tzitzit,
mm-hmm.
that are tied at the end. I do not weave the fringe. I'll distinguish these. I'll call them tzitzit as opposed to the fringes, which are the warp threads of the talus. These tzitzit come from Israel. They have been spun. They're wool. They have been spun strictly for tzitzit by very Orthodox people. And this is how I buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Orthodox people will not accept my talasim with the knots tied. This is the mitzvah, to tie the knots. The threads, the eight threads, plus the knots, plus the, in the Hebrew alphabet, every letter has a numerical value, plus numerical values add up to 613. 613 are the number of mitzvot, or commandments that one is to aim for as a Jew.
Okay.
There are two ways of tying the tzitzit. One, I started to do it until I was told differently, and I don't do it anymore. Strictly by a man, the ultra-Orthodox sect, Lubavitch, and I won't tie that anymore that way because a Lubavitch ties it and wears it, and I'm a woman, and I must respect that. Mm-hmm. There is a prescribed way of tying this, and when you make your 7, 8, 11, and 13 wrappings, they are never to be a fraction of an inch less or a fraction of an inch more. They must be exact, which is why I love the Lubavitch way, because they have a way of a slip knot that makes it exact. Mm-hmm. At any rate, what I'm saying is what I learned from Leviticus. I don't know how it applies to commercial tallit. The patch, if the tallit is wool, the patch must be wool. The tzitzit are always wool. Mm-hmm. Now, it says in Leviticus, I hope I'm interpreting it right, if you have a tallit that is not wool and you're putting wool tzitzit on it, the separation is used by leather patches. I've never seen it, but that sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Do those patches have a special name?
No, they're patches.
And they have a special use? I mean,
they're just to reinforce. They're just to reinforce this.
But they're traditionally located in the bottom.
Well, a tallit must be a four-cornered garment. Mm-hmm. That's the two corners in the front and two corners in the back. In other words, although when a man throws it over his shoulder, the four corners look as if they're in the front, but they're not. It must be a garment and not a shawl, which means it must at least cover the shoulders. Now, when I speak to various knowledgeable men, I'm discontinuing my smallest size, which is for bar mitzvah. I'm making it larger because it should reach. Some men have told me the small of the back. Some have told me the break in the back of the knee. So that I feel that more is better than less. The only other, there is no other prescription. There are little goodies I throw in. Mm-hmm. Now, when the atara, the neckband is called the atara. Now, traditionally, it was a fancy design, or there was a prayer embroidered on there. It was usually white on white or metallic. I do my atarot to blend with the pattern of the tallit. When one requests it upon ordering it, I have it embroidered. There was one rabbi who had it embroidered. He is a widower, and he had me embroider his. Well, he had it embroidered. I now have an embroiderer. I don't have time. He had it embroidered with a blessing that his wife used to say when she would arise in the morning. So there are many. You can make it as mystical or as prosaic as you would like.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we were talking earlier about the design on the pattern of the tallit itself.
You mean the cross-cultural? Oh,
right.
The traditionally, in Europe, they were black and white of varying widths, what we call bound weave.
Is that prescribed, that there's stripes of...
Not as much as I can. Nothing is written in stone that I'm telling you, because I may discover something tomorrow that's different.
But
as far as I know, nothing other than the fact that it's a garment, the law of shatnet and the tzitzit are prescribed.
So your creativity, that's the strictures that you can work with.
Yes, I work within those parameters. Originally, they were all black and white, bound weave. Then it started, they added blue and white stripes. And now, whatever your fancy takes you, that isn't bizarre. You wanted to know about the where it says, "And you shall tie a fringe of blue, a thread of blue," on the tzitzit.
That was the tradition. You're saying
no, many. I have never seen it,
right. So
but it does say within within Leviticus that the tzitzit shall be tied. They call it the fringe, shall be tied with a thread of blue. Now, it's never used. It hasn't been used, I think, for centuries, because the snail, we thought was extinct. It may not be. I'm hearing news from Israel that they have discovered. This was a cross-cultural thing. What happened was, for the Jews, it's a ritual thing, and millions of little tiny snails to extract a little bit of the indigo blue. It's a purplish blue with a little pink in it if you break down the spectrum. What happened was it's also the royal blue of royalty, so that even other cultures wanted it. That's an indication of royalty. But so what happened was, when it became extinct, I read that there were fake dyes being passed off as tichelet, and it was discontinued. Now there are stories, I'm beginning to hear rumors that they've rediscovered it in the waters in Israel. I hope it's so, but I don't know.
When I speak it.